Then together you started a company based on a very sophisticated invention that you came up with, maybe the first of about 30 patents that you now have. You ran this company for a long time, then you moved back to Kentucky, and a lot of things happened, and you wound up running for Congress. So, like,
Right.
that's not the background.
Well, so nothing in the political arena, but in my private life, I raised $32 million of venture capital and I swam with the sharks. Like, I had lots of moral dilemmas in the course of creating that company. I could have taken money off the table and gone and done other things, but instead I felt a commitment to my staff and to other investors. I had investors who said, if you'll just shit can that guy you hired as president, we'll double our investment. And I'm like, no, he's my partner. I'm not like he helped me get to this point. I'm not going to abandon him.
Good for you.
And so, I had experiences in life that, and then also just put my hands in the dirt on my farm.
So tell me about that. So you live, tell us about how you live and where you live, because I think it's one of the most unusual things about you.
So I spent, I grew up as a hillbilly in eastern Kentucky,
What county?
Lewis County.
Lewis County. How many people in your town?
13,000 people, 13,000 cattle. It's a huge land mass. It's a great county. It's one of the 21 counties that I represent. Actually the poorest county per capita income that I represent, but it's the one I grew up in. So it's very unlikely that the congressman for the district would come from the poorest county. So I grew up as a little nerd. I loved taking stuff apart because I was bored. There were no malls. You couldn't ride your bicycle to any, store and if you did, you didn't have any money. So I had to find things to do at home. I took apart things, built things, entered science fairs, built robots, made it to the International Science Fair as a little, hillbilly, won an award from NASA there. And at the age 15, like I won the high school level awards, and got into MIT, never visited the campus, didn't really have the money to go visit it. But I read about it. There was no internet. Seemed like a good place. I got there. I'd lived in a town of 1,900 people all my life. And I was there for 6 hours in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I cross Massachusetts Avenue. They had a crosswalk and a stoplight. I'd never really seen two of those things together. I'd seen crosswalks and stoplights, but so I walked through the crosswalk and a car honked, like that short little Boston, meep, meep. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've been here 6 hours and already run into somebody from Kentucky. And I turned around and waved at the car as big as I could.
Was it people from Kentucky?
I don't think so. I think they had one finger up waving back. And people are like, that's not a true story. I said, not only is it true, it took me a month to quit waving at cars that beeped. Like it was just 18 years of conditioning.
You thought beeping was, hey.
Hey there. I mean, that's what we thought that little thing in the middle of your steering wheel was for. If you saw somebody and they couldn't see you through the windshield, just toot the horn. And then you throw your hand up and wave, and they roll down the window. Oh, that's Bob. And if you didn't wave, I mean, you were a pariah. You were probably an axe murderer who was in our town, right? Or you were just an a-hole. So I didn't want to be either, so I waved at that car in Massachusetts. And kept waving for about a month. But anyways, long story short, as you said, I invented a virtual reality device that lets you touch three-dimensional objects, started a company, raised venture capital, did that for 10 years, moved to the live free or die state,
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. My company was in Massachusetts. I couldn't move the center of gravity too far out of Cambridge. I got it up to 128 on Woburn, and then I commuted 40 miles every day so I could live in a state that let you have machine guns and old cars and, cool stuff. Redneck sports.
The best.
The best sports. So,
Why'd you move back to Kentucky?
after 10 years, of doing it, it was, we had three kids. And we wanted to raise them like we were raised in Kentucky. And we wanted them to be near their grandparents. Like both of my parents were still alive. Both my wife's parents were still alive. And you learn so much from your grandparents
That's
because
for
your
sure.
parents are really busy just, trying to earn a living or whatever. And if you're lucky enough to have a relationship with your grandparents, that's where I think the generational stuff carries on.
Yes.
And, I had a great relationship with my grandparents. So we wanted our kids to live in that environment. And we came back, we bought the farm that my wife grew up on. We built a house off the grid. It runs on a wrecked Model S Tesla battery. It's been running continuously for 6.5 years.
So you built the house? Like, who built the house?
I did. Like, we had an ice storm and a lot of trees fell down.
How big is the property?
It's 1,500 acres.
And it's wooded.
It's almost all woods. Like, and it's too steep. I don't want you to think this is like valuable Iowa.
No. Like, I know the part of the state you're in.
Yeah. Pack your lunch if you're on the ridge and you fall off the ridge, because you're going to be hungry by the time you get to the bottom. You're going to be grabbing like tree roots and stuff to keep from sliding. But it grows trees and some of it is flat and, you know, in the bottom.
But this is not plantation land.
No,
this
these are hollers.
Yeah.
So, in fact, interestingly enough, it's been a Republican county since the Civil War, even yes. though all the counties around it have been Democrats since the Civil War.
Because of the geography.
Because of the geography.
Yes.
The topography did not allow for consolidation of farms.
Right.
So there was no scale at which slavery made sense. You basically, in your holler, you only had enough land that your family, if you had enough kids, could farm.
Yes.
And so that's the way people grew up. And by the way, it's kind of libertarian. You know, I'll do my thing in my holler. You do your thing in your holler.
That's right.
If you need some help, let me know. I'll come over and help you.
But Southwest Virginia is like this. West Virginia is like this.
Yeah.
Because of the topography.
Right. It's the reason West Virginia was Republican and seceded from Virginia. So, by the way, half my family's from West Virginia and half my family's from Kentucky. My mamaw's, who's 97 right now, is still alive. Her grandfather was a Union soldier.
Amazing.
Isn't that crazy?
From West Virginia.
From West Virginia, yeah. She still lives in West Virginia. But, like, we're not that far away from the Civil War.
No, I know. I know.
You can talk to people who were alive when people who fought in the Civil War.
I worked with a guy when I was at the newspaper in Arkansas. The guy I shared a desk with, Bob Salee from Texarkana, Arkansas. He said, I knew Confederate veterans. It's in my lifetime. I knew a man who knew Confederate veterans or Civil War veterans. That's just absolutely crazy.
But my whole point of that was she's a Republican. She's been a Republican, my mamaw, since the Civil War. And, like, nobody marries into our family if you're a Democrat. You got to go see mamaw, and she'll either approve or disapprove. And she's had pretty good luck at sniffing out
the liberals. Democrats.
Yeah, the liberals.
So you had an ice storm. There was an ice storm on your property. Yeah. How does that figure into your house?
So I already had a bulldozer. So I got a winch so I could drag these trees out. I got a sawmill, cut these into timbers, built a timber frame house.
What kind of wood?
It's 17 kinds of wood because it was whatever fell down in the ice storm. We've got oak, yellow poplar, hickory, beech.
So hardwood.
Hardwood, yep. And then we wanted it to be self-sustaining.
Like, how did you know how to timber frame?
I found a class on eBay for $500 in Tennessee, and I bought it now. And I drove to Tennessee and took a one-week class, and we built a little shed/cabin. And I called my wife from a payphone, and I said, I want to do this. Like, instead of going to get a job, we had just left our company after 10 years of working there, and we'd moved back to Kentucky. And I said, well, I'll just build a timber frame house.
Like full time.
Yes. Woke up every morning, had my coffee, and started chiseling away or going up in the woods and dragging more trees out that had fallen down.
So you built your house full time, like as a job, every day.
And this is what our kids saw too. Like the flooring for our kitchen came out of the creek. We call it a crick.
What do you mean the flooring came out of the creek?
There are rocks in the crick that are flat, that they look like the stuff you buy at Lowe's that's fake. And I'm like, oh, this is what they modeled the fake stuff after. It's free. Let's just go pick it up. Now, we're paying ourselves about $3 an hour compared to if we had just gone to, you know, one of the box stores and bought it in terms of harvesting it. But our kids, I think, in addition to being with their grandparents, learned a big lesson that, wow, mom and dad are growing our food. They are collecting the materials for the house here from the environment, that you don't have to rely. You know, neighbors are good, though, right? We actually sent them to public school, and we let them ride the bus. It was only 3 miles away, but we figured the bus ride was important, too, because when you get to school, they sort of separate you.
Oh, yeah.
But you've got, can be 15 terrifying minutes on the bus where you interact with everybody, right? I remember my son, he was like 10 years old. He traded some Yu-Gi-Oh cards on the bus and for this like awesome, the best Yu-Gi-Oh card ever. And he showed it to us and it was a little plastic thing. And we're like, well, did you want to take it out of plastic? No, no. He told me to leave it in here. And we take it out and it was a fake. And he was so mad. But it turns out his dad had sold me a leaky bulldozer and said there was no leaks in it. So, like,
it ran in the family.
In the family. The same kid who stiffed my son had stiffed me on this dozer.
So where, I mean.
But so, you learn these are life lessons, right? They didn't lead a sheltered life. And so we grew up, you know, they grew up there.
Wait, what percent of the timbers in the timber frame came from your property?
All of it. What in fact, percent? They never left the farm.
Really? So you milled it there?
Milled it there, chiseled it there, made the mortise and tenons and the dovetails. It was a lot of work.
Personally?
Yes.
How did you, you know, cutting a mortise and tenon, cutting a dovetail joint, these are, having done it, very difficult. How did you learn to do that?
I kept telling myself, look, farmers without calculators pulled this off 200 years ago. And so surely if I've got a computer and some, you know, electricity, I should be able to do this as well. Just dent of will.
But you'd been like a electrical engineer, electrical engineer, software programmer.
Right.
But not,
nothing that scale. Yeah. Nothing. I mean, the only thing I had built before that was a tree house. Right. And even that didn't get finished.
So, but I mean, some of that stuff is very complex, like actually complex. Timber framing, some of the joints are difficult to cut, and the design itself is complicated.
Yeah, you don't like, you have to plan it all ahead. You don't like hold the timber up there like you would a 2x4.
It's not,
oh, we need a saw.
It's not balloon framing. Right, no, yeah. Totally right.
Or, oh, that 45 needs to be a 42 degree angle. Let's, you know, saw off a little bit more. You can't do that while it's, you know, you're up in the middle of the air on scaffolding trying to get two pieces to fit together. It's actually, it's a fun math problem. So I enjoyed it, but is there something honest about it? Because all the fasteners are wooden too. So it's one medium that you learn. There's no like bolts.
So it's all pegs.
Nails, all pegs. And once you realize that, and
so there are no metal fasteners in the frame.
Correct.
None.
I mean, we had to nail the floor to
the frame. I got it.
And the walls on it.
Of course. But
the frame itself,
the frame that
no metal fasteners.
Structure.
And it's 46 feet tall.
It's 46 feet tall?
Yes. From the basement slab, which I timber framed the basement too. I still don't even know how to stick frame. Like, I'm like, well, I'm going to build one house. I'm going to learn one technology.
Which is the framing that your house is, yeah. If you're watching this. It's stick frame.
It's stick frame. So I was like, well, let's build the basement timber frame too. And the dormers, like if you paid a company to build timber frame, they would stick frame the dormers.
Well, of course, or buy them and just bolt them on.
Right.
Yeah.
I timber framed that. I'm just like, let's just be pure the whole way. And as an engineer, I thought, well, I want to build a house with timbers. I like how timbers look, but.
Me too.
But, you know, we'll just bolt them together. We'll use iron brackets. That's the best way to do it. But in the course of this 1 week class, I came to realize, wow, if you just let go and make everything out of wood, it solves problems that you would create when you start using metal fasteners. Like wood shrinks, right?
Yes.
It takes like 6 or 8 years for a big timber to fully dry out. So how do you deal with metal fasteners and shrinking wood? Well, the metal fasteners can rip out. But if you build your fasteners out of wood, like it can all work.
It moves together.
And there's, you know, if you go to Germany, you know, there's homes that are 400 or 500 years old to show that it can work. So
all the timbers came from the property. What about the stone? There's a lot of stone in the house.
Yep. We got some of it out of the creek. We dug some of it out of the ground. All of the stone is from the property.
How did you dig it out of the ground? What does that mean? You started a stone quarry on your own property?
In my front yard. It's now a pond. But there was an old logging road and the erosion had exposed this layer of rock. And I thought, well, that layer of rock must go pretty far. So I started digging using a backhoe. I started digging the dirt off of that layer of rock. And I'm like, wow, there are lots of rocks here. And I almost giggled out loud when I shoved on that layer of rock with my backhoe and all these rocks started rolling out in front of the blade. And they looked like rocks you could buy at the store. You know, like, well, why would I go buy them? Like, I can just like shove 3 tons of them out of here in, you know, a few minutes. And then I had people coming and visiting. Obviously, we looked like a bunch of weirdos building this timber frame house up on the hill, and people would come up. And
where were you living at this point?
We lived in a mobile home. Like, we just pulled in a mobile home, and I told my wife we'd only live in it for like 6 months. We ended up 2 years in a 900 square foot mobile home with four kids.
No way.
It's actually not that bad. You get to know your family really well. You can hear.
It's like being on a boat.
Yeah. You try to go to the bathroom, and if you're gone for more than 5 minutes, like, the wall between the kitchen and the bathroom is so thin. You're just enjoying private moment there on the throne, trying to read a magazine about timber framing or something. Right. And you can hear the kids at the dinner table saying, "Where'd daddy go? Where's daddy? Where's daddy?" And then they start trying to find daddy. Anyways, it was a good, comfy experience. And now we actually kept the mobile home and we lease it to deer hunters.
And really?
Yeah. It's a double wide. So it's full of deer heads and bunk beds now. And the hunters call it the lodge, which we find amusing. My wife calls it the double lodge since it's a double wide.
Do you have a lot of deer on your land?
We have, yeah, trophy deer all over.
What do you charge to rent it, just in case people are interested?
We're booked up.
you don't want any weird internet people in
right,
your land.
Yeah, we are booked up. Yes.
So call how ahead. Long did it take you to finish this house?
It's not finished. I've been criticized. You know, in campaigns, people try to use this against me. Some guy goes, "He doesn't even have doors on all his rooms. He's some kind of weirdo." Great. Well, we haven't made that door yet, right?
You're making the doors?
We have made a few of them, yeah. We're kind of breaking down now and buying a few doors now that the kids are gone.
So that was like your kids. Wait, so what year did you start? How long has this process been?
So we started in 2003. So we're
21 years.
21 years. And we've been off the grid that long, too. Again.
No, when you say off the grid, what do you mean?
We're not connected to any public utility. Not electricity, not water, not sewer, not phone. The house is totally disconnected from everything.
Did you build those systems yourself?
Yeah. Using a lot of it's off the shelf stuff, but some of it's improvised, field expedient.
So like for
like the Tesla battery, the car battery that runs the house.
Well, you can't
buy that out of a catalog. You go to a junkyard and say, "How much do you want for that wrecked Model S?" And like, "Well, I'll sell you the battery for $15,000.
Why not? Why can't you just buy the battery separately?
They won't, like, Tesla wouldn't sell me a Powerwall. I tried to buy one for years.
Why?
Because it has to be connected to the grid for some reason. Their business model involves that. So I was like, all right, well, I'll get a battery. How much different can it be from the batteries in their car? So I drove to Lake Lanier, Georgia with a little trailer, landscaping trailer. The battery weighs, I think, 1,200 pounds. But here's the funny thing. It's considered hazardous material if you pull it on a trailer. But if it's in a car, it's just fine. So I hurried up and got back to Kentucky with the trailer. I don't have a hazmat license.
So it was a wrecked Tesla Model S, and you pulled the battery out of it.
Yeah.
And what'd you do with it?
Disassembled it. I paid $15,000 cash. But this is like, you know, this is probably like 15 or 20 years. Hopefully it'll last. And so I brought it home, took it apart. Actually, I made a YouTube video of this. And what's kind of funny is I had these big rubber gloves that a friend who had worked on power lines, you know, they were leftovers, and he gave to me. And so, like, in the YouTube video, I try to make sure, like, I'm using big rubber gloves and stuff. And I did, like, this fast forward, you know, of the disassembly of the battery. And I forgot, like, my two little boys are in there helping me, and they don't have the gloves on.
They haven't earned the right to have gloves.
Don't put stuff on the internet. Like, I have a Tesla Model S, one of the very first ones made, and I've got Friends of Cole license plates on it. Like, in Kentucky, you can get Friends of Cole. It's a totally black.
Oh, Cole, C-O-A-L.
C-O-A-L, yeah. Oh,
sorry.
So, because in Kentucky, that's, if you plug into the grid, that's likely where your electricity is coming.
Well, I would think, yeah.
So I'm driving this thing back from D.C. This was when gas was, you know, getting close to $5 a gallon. It was over $4 a gallon. And I stopped in West Virginia to charge my Tesla at a supercharging station, just to kind of troll people on the internet. And I made sure to get a picture of my Friends of Coal license plate. And I said, "I'm just charging up with coal here in West Virginia." And within 30 seconds, I knew I'd made a mistake because somebody had zoomed in on the picture and my tags were expired. And they started tagging the Kentucky State Police, my local sheriff, the DMV in Kentucky.
Way.
Like, they were trying to get me in trouble. And I'm like, there's no way to stop this now. And so they were relentless. And, but then somebody realized they had been expired for 18 months and that I'd actually made it a year without paying taxes and was maybe likely to get out of a year of taxes.
Well, it's your win then.
Yeah. But, in Kentucky, I think they make you go back and pay the old taxes. Anyways, what I learned there is like, search everything in the picture before you put it on the
internet. Well, yes. And others with zestier personal lives than you have learned this the hard way.
Mine's not very zesty.
No, it doesn't seem. You've got enough
minor,
to do.
Minor tax evasion issue here.
Right. You don't have time to be too weird. So you get the Tesla battery back to your off-grid house. And
yeah.
What do you have to do? Because it's not made for this. It's a car
right.
battery.
It's a car battery. It's made to run 400 volts. All of my existing system was made to run on 48 volts. But there were 16 modules, each nominally 25 volts. And I realized if you put two of those in series, you could make 50 volts. So I put eight sets of two in series. And so I put paralleled eight sets of two in series. So I got 50 volts at a lot more amperage than what the Tesla car would normally draw. It was capable of doing that. And
hard is that to do?
Well, I mean, it took a few days, but it's lasted for 6.5 years. I wouldn't advise doing this at home. Like,
why?
Put it in an outbuilding. I mean, if it catches on fire, it's probably like Chernobyl, that mini series. Like, don't look at the reactor. God cannot put out. He created lithium ion, but he can't put the fire out if it starts. So I would not attach it to your house. Mine is like,
is it attached to your house?
Kind of. Yeah. It's like a basement room that's not under the house. Like, I don't want to get into everything under my house right now. Okay. So my wife says our house is my science project and she's the mouse and she doesn't mind that, but I keep rearranging the maze on the weekends when I come back from DC and then she has to find the cheese while I'm in DC. But she's more like the astronaut, I think, in a rocket.
I think that's exactly
right. She's the only
it's the same trust level required.
Correct. Yes. She trusts me while I'm in DC and I trust her to fly the house while she's in Kentucky.
So what? She's also an MIT graduate, so I assume she kind of understands some of the stuff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Although she would like to have just one thing in the house where if something went wrong, she could call somebody, but she can't. She's got to like call me and then I walk her through it. By the way, it's good like marriage security, but it's just like, if we ever broke up or if let's say she put something in my coffee and I didn't wake up the next day, she'd have a hard time running the house.
So you put the nodules, which is basically
modules,
just separate batteries, right? Okay. Within that,
within the big battery,
full battery.
Then I put a computer on it, a Raspberry Pi, and I made a little graphic screen, and the Raspberry Pi using, an Arduino talks to the CAN bus, which is a proprietary Tesla communication system. So I use the battery management system that's native to the Tesla battery modules. If there's a nerd listening to this, this makes complete sense. And they'll be like, oh, well, why wouldn't you do that? And everybody else is going to be like, he's just BSing.
So did you have to add new software to this to run it?
I had to write software from scratch. Yeah. But it's fun. Like, this is what I do. Look, I've been in Congress for 12 years. My brain has atrophied to the size of a walnut. Actually to a raisin, and it expands to a walnut if I can go home and do these projects, and then I go back to DC and it's back down to the raisin.
I believe that. I don't understand how these projects work, but I know what brain atrophy looks like, and I know that Congress induces it.
It's not a worm, it just shrinks.
So how does it work? Like,
it works great. We can run the air conditioner. Like, for the first 11 years, we had lead acid batteries and they didn't work that great. You had to add water to them.
Oh, for sure.
They put off hydrogen gas, which is explosive.
Well, I know.
They put off a sulfide gas that can kill you. Like, lead acids or batteries are bad and they're like over 100 years old. But by the way, I love solar panels. Like, Republicans are like, they look at me like, you have solar panels? You have an electric car? Like, are you sure you're one of us? I'm like, well, the solar panels are rocks that make electricity. Like, they are amazing things. They take sunlight and turn it into something we can all use. So you could hate, I tell Republicans, you can hate the subsidies, you can hate the bailouts, you can hate the mandates. I hate all of those things as well. But don't hate solar panels.
Don't hate the technology.
Right, because it's actually given me and can give other people a license to be independent from the
power. So let's get specific about it. So you have this Tesla battery that allows you to do everything a normal house can do. You can run air conditioning, you've got a dishwasher, you've got washer dryer, I'm assuming all this.
Four deep freezers, refrigerator.
Four deep freezers?
Full of peaches, beef, and chickens.
Running continuously.
Continuously.
So your power draw is significant on all those appliances, obviously.
Yeah.
And the battery handles it fine. How much propane or how much diesel or what? I assume you have a generator to recharge.
Backup generator that backup. Runs occasionally in the winter. But I keep every time.
So your solar panels recharge the battery?
Yeah. For 9 months out of the year, the backup generator doesn't run except for its like test run every Friday.
Yeah, exactly.
When we bust out the machine guns, like, who's in the driveway? Oh, okay, back down to level one. That's just the backup generator.
So your electricity is, as long as you know how to operate the system, which apparently only you do, but if you can do that, then you're just living a completely normal life.
Correct.
With electricity.
Correct.
How do you do heat? How do you heat your house?
So in one of the greenest ways possible. Like, I think the whole carbon thing is a scam.
Of course it's a scam.
But if you do care about carbon neutrality, I wish we had more carbon. We need more CO2.
Yeah.
And at periods in the Earth's history, we had more CO2 and plant life was doing better. And we've seen plant life, we've seen the coverage of green on the globe increase as CO2 levels go up. Crop production goes up as CO2 levels go up. But if you did care about CO2, I am using wood on my farm, like just trees that fall down. I'm not even going out and cutting a living tree. There's enough trees falling down.
Deadfall.
That if I don't get to them, the termites do.
That's right.
And they turn them into CO2 and methane. But I can get to them and cut them up and bring them to my house and burn them in a wood gasifying boiler, which is super efficient. Once you start cutting wood for heat, efficiency, like if you figure out a boiler is twice as efficient, you can cut half as much.
So because anyone who's made it this far in the interview is probably interested in wood gasification. Can you explain what that is? How is it different from a normal wood-fired boiler or a wood stove?
Yeah, in a normal wood stove, you put the wood in there. It can be green. You light it on fire. You get it going, and then you control the air that goes to it to keep it from getting too hot. And a lot of smoke comes out, especially when it's idling, because it's an inefficient combustion process, and it's at a relatively low temperature, under, let's say, 1,000 degrees.
Right.
But in a wood gasifying boiler, you get the fire started, and it basically turns the wood into charcoal and drives the gases out of it into a secondary chamber that's ceramic because it's burning at over 1,500 degrees. So some of the stuff that wood...
How do you get wood to burn that hot?
You deprive it of oxygen at first and get it hot, and then you drive all the gases off and you put more oxygen in that secondary chamber, and it looks like it's burning gas. Like it'll be a blue flame, and then it'll turn into a yellow flame. It starts out actually.
And this is just oak, maple, beech. This is just conventional firewood.
I burn near wood. Nearest wood to the house, right?
Like near wood. I don't remember that. Near wood.
Yeah, near wood. Nearest.
Can you burn softwood in it?
You can, but the BT, again, if you're doing this yourself, about efficiency. Like if you look at the old timers, they were the greenest people on the planet, right? They didn't waste a thing, and they figured out the most efficient way to do things because it was minutes out of their lives.
Yes.
So you start figuring out how to be more efficient when you're trying to be self-sustaining. So I've got on my Twitter bio, I used to say, and it may still say this on there, greenest member of Congress. That doesn't mean I just got there and I'm green. I never got any of the fact checkers to come after me on that. Nobody wants to fact check me because I probably am the greenest member of Congress. Who has self-sustaining food, self-sustaining without externalities, right? Self-sustaining power, self-sustaining water.
So you heat with wood. How much wood do you burn, would you say, a season?
The size of this table, maybe four stacks of wood the size of this table.
So this is about a cord. So this is about a cord is 4x4x8. So this is like roughly that. So about 4 quarts a year.
Yep.
That's not much. That's impressive. How do you get hot water?
We've got 3 ways to make hot water. When our geothermal unit's running in the summertime, doing the air conditioning, it takes the heat out of the living room and puts it in the hot water tank. So we have free hot water from like May until September when the air conditioner's running. And then in the winter, when the boiler, the wood boiler is running, that makes hot water. And then if there's ever not the air conditioner running or the boiler running, we have an on-demand, this is where we cheat, on-demand propane hot water heater that makes up the difference.
Amazing. But you could pretty easily set up a wood-fired outdoor.
You could.
Yeah.
But in the summer, again, you get it for free from the air conditioning. I actually have a fourth way to make hot water too. So when we're not connected to the grid, a lot of people who have solar panels are connected to the grid.
Yes.
And if they have extra power, they sell it back.
Right.
I'm always depressed when I have extra power. My solar panels just turn off and I'm like, run around, turn on some lights, you know, turn on something. I don't want to waste this free electricity. So I got extra hot water heater elements that run on DC so that when the sun, when our house is full, the first thing it does is it tries to charge the Tesla that's sitting in the garage. So the Tesla's sitting there at half full and a solid state breaker in my breaker box comes on and starts the Tesla charging. Then when the Tesla gets full and the house battery is full, I create hot water with the electricity. So I've got like a fourth way to make hot water. Hot water is almost as good as water. I mean, if you've ever gone without water, you know it's bad.
Yeah.
But going out without hot water is almost just as bad. It,
yeah. I have experience with that. Yes. It's, where do you get your water?
So I dug a well.
Not drill.
Dug it. There are lots of old dug wells on our farm, so I knew it could work.
Yeah.
The way they would do it, they would dig a big pit.
Yes.
They didn't dig it just straight down. They dug a big pit. And then they laid up stones in a circle, you know, the stones you see when you look in an old well. But then they backfilled the pit with stones.
Yep.
So that extra area becomes like a reservoir. And then they put dirt on top of that so that, you know, when a raccoon poops next to your well, it doesn't necessarily go right into the reservoir. So I did a very similar thing, but I hit bedrock and I borrowed a friend's jackhammer and spent a day inside of that hole with a jackhammer trying to get even deeper through the bedrock. I finally took my friend's jackhammer back and said, okay, that's deep enough.
What was the jackhammer like?
I mean, that's the best argument for public health care that exists. Because I have a new appreciation for somebody that's running a jackhammer. Those would wear your body out quickly.
Like really quickly.
Yeah.
Did you lose a crown?
I did not lose a crown.
So does the dug well work?
It works. 1 month out of the year, we're kind of short on water.
Yeah. August. So,
yes, August. How'd you know that? Have you ever?
I have a dug well.
Lived in this situation.
Yes, I have a dug well, so I'm aware of that.
But again, you conserve, right?
Of course.
If you're connected to city water and it seems what's on the other side is opaque to you, you just use as much as you want. And what happens is during those peak periods, that's when the utility company has to work extra hard. That's when the price and the inefficiency goes way up, is in those peak periods when people aren't cutting back in response to the supply because the actual cost of producing it isn't known. When you're making it yourself, it's known. But I've argued that water and electricity, even when they come from, especially when they come from utilities, should have variable pricing based on the instant, the cost at that very instant to produce it. And then you could have appliances not mandated, but smart appliances. If you're rich, you don't care when the price of power goes up.
You don't know what it costs.
You don't know what it costs. If you're poor and you've got a little screen that says the power just went up, you'll go turn it off, right?
100%.
You'll say, we'll do the dishes tonight, right? When it's cheaper. And if you're middle income, you'll probably eventually the market will respond to this and automate these things so that, you know, if you know the price of electricity, your appliance can know the price. I don't want the utility company to know what you're doing with it.
Of course not.
But you can have these smart systems that make a lot more efficient use of our resources.
So because you're not connected to the grid, to any public utility at all, I mean, you're actually independent in a way that no one outside of Alaska I've ever met is. And it sounds like you're not giving up anything. You're not living in a...
Not too much. There are some sacrifices.
Like?
Well, you know, if it's cloudy for a lot of days and hot, we may turn the thermostat up.
Yeah.
Just so we don't have to hear the backup generator run.
That doesn't seem like a crazy sacrifice.
There's some people would think the instant they had to turn the thermostat from 72 to 75 would be, screw it, I'm out of here. I'm going back to the grid.
But it means that the state kind of has no control over your land.
Correct. Or me.
Or you.
So when I go to D.C. and they threaten me or try to bribe me, it's like, I know once Friday comes, I'm going to be back on my farm and I don't need them. Like, it's not that I don't want to do things for people. I help my neighbors and my neighbors help me, and I want to, you know, do public service. But because I have this comfort level that I'm going to go back home to this, I don't need the job. We're self-sustaining. It gives you an extra dimension of independence, I think, when you're in D.C.
What about food? Can they starve you out?
I don't think so. Like, they can cut off my fish supply because we don't raise fish and we don't raise pork, but we raise chicken, meat and eggs. We raise beef, and we usually raise a pretty good garden. And I have an orchard. Peaches, lots of peaches. My first peach is going to be ripe here in a few weeks, and my last peach will be ripe in September. So I've planted 14 kinds of peach trees, so they get ripe different weeks, and they taste nothing like the cardboard peaches you buy at the supermarket.
So you don't need to leave, actually, your farm?
No. Are you trying to talk me out of, like, I mean, this is a crisis I have some weeks.
I bet.
Oh man, on Mondays, it's like, you know, you're going to get hit with a 2x4 as soon as you walk in the door in DC. It's like,
is it weird that, I mean, I guess what I'm struck by, I don't live off grid, though I do have an off grid camp, but the amount of skills you need to build something like that is really, really striking. Like, you actually have to know how to do things, complex things. I mean, timber framing is another level, but electrical, plumbing, masonry, agriculture, heavy equipment operation. Like, you can do all of that, obviously. So is it weird to be in a room with 434 people who can't do shit, who can't operate a micro? I mean, they're like actually incapable, and maybe that's why they're in politics, so they can externalize their self-loathing. Is that weird?
I really don't think about it that much.
Good.
I don't think about it.
Where'd you pick up plumbing skills?
So my rule is buy 3 books for everything. Because you can go to a hardware store and buy a book on plumbing, but I don't trust one book. So you buy 2 books. And then if the 2 books disagree, what are you going to do? Well, you got to have a 3rd book. So I've got 3 books on plumbing, 3 books on wiring, 3 books on septic systems, three books on
you did your septic too.
Roofing. Yep. I get 3 books on everything.
And you read them.
And I read them. And then there's the code book, which is like, you know, it's almost like international housing code thing that some municipalities have adopted and you have to abide by. I just look at that as like a suggestion manual.
So do you think, now we're way in the weeds, I don't know if anyone's watching, but they're like 4 handymen, carpenter, general contractors are still in this, but do you think that code, which really determines how people live in this country, the code, it's not up to code, is it real? I mean, is it, knowing what you do about all those different trades, does the code protect people, actually?
It protects the contractors.
Look, well, I know that.
And so they help write it, the unions do. So, for instance, the roofers union and the plumbers union, I think, have conspired to put as many holes in your roof with plumbing as possible, right? Because
all the venting.
Yeah, all the vents, right? If you try to build a house to code, you're likely to have 4 or 5 perforations in your roof.
I've noticed.
And that keeps the roofers busy. Like, they're guaranteed to get a call every few years to fix that leak. And it's also very expensive. It's fairly cheap to do roofing, but it's all the exceptions that cost money. And then if you're a plumber, that's one more thing.
Like all the flashing and all the, every time you have an aperture in a roof.
Yes.
Like that's a vulnerability.
So my roof has no holes in it. Like I looked at this and I'm like, well, that's a good suggestion, but who benefits if I believe
what they're telling me? So you vent your stove out the side of the building, not the...
No, no holes in my roof, no holes out the side. Have you seen that opera house in, I think it's Sydney, Australia?
Yeah, famous opera.
Is it Sydney or Melbourne?
Sydney.
Okay.
Sydney Opera House.
Yeah. There's no holes in that. There's bathrooms in there. How do they do it? They have the one-way admittance valves like you have under your kitchen counter. They have giant ones of those that work for the whole system. And they're not to code, but I think that's stupid because why would I want to put a bunch of holes in my roof?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm interested in this topic, so.
But nobody else is now, by the way.
But for the four people who are, I've always wondered that. Why, with wood stoves, where I live, everyone has lots of wood stoves. And some of them, I have wood stoves that vent out the side of the building, like next to a window, and then do an L up. It's not quite as efficient, you know, because you've got to turn in the run. But you don't have a hole in your roof, and in a climate with like lots of snow, for example, you don't want any holes in your roof.
Right.
But how do you vent your furnace, for example?
So that I just run in a typical flue, and it goes up in the chimney with my pizza oven flue, my wood cook stove flue, and my Rumford fireplace flue. So I have four flues through the chimney.
On the gable end?
No, they're in the middle of the house. I put the chimney in the middle of the house because it's a big thermal mass, and I wanted to smooth out the changes in temperature in the house. And so there's where I did accommodate one hole in the roof is the chimney. Because if you put a big stone mass on the side of your house, there's no way to insulate it from the outside. So, but by the way, let me say something. Like, I know there are some women watching this wondering, like, I want to live in a house like that. That sounds like a lot of fun. Talk to my wife first. Occasionally we have like some crisis that I have to solve and become MacGyver. So the first time I got elected to Congress, for instance, the day before I went to go get sworn in, the well pump failed.
Ooh.
And I'm like, I can't leave my wife and four kids at home without water. And we have a very unique well pump.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I didn't buy the one at the hardware store, so you couldn't go replace it. So I went down there.
Wait, and what did you buy?
It's like in a catalog somewhere. Like the engineer in me found the best one. Okay, it's not the most common one, but I had to fix it. So what I did is I found one of my drills, you know, like you drill holes with.
Yeah.
And I took it down to the well. And I took the motor off the well pump and I chucked the drill to the well head. And because it's not submerged, it's off the side in a pump house. And I wired this, you know, had an outlet on it, but I just wired it into the well pump wiring. And the drill pumped water for our house.
I believe that.
Long enough for me to go get sworn in.
I've seen that. I've seen drills run winches.
Yes. Well, I forgot it was there. Like I did my Congress thing for.
But you had it on continuously?
Yeah, and then the accumulator in the basement that controls the pressure would turn the drill off and on whenever it needed more water pressure. And so it ran continuously. I forgot about it. I just got busy. And like a year later, a freaking water quit working again.
Because the Makita died?
Right. It was actually a Milwaukee hole.
It was?
The hole hog, you know, one of those
breakers. Yeah. You know, I totally do with the handle on the side.
Yeah.
Those are cool drills. So right. you, last night, I just want to end with this. Last night we were having dinner and which was really one of the most interesting, amusing dinners I've ever had. But you made reference to a story, but you didn't get a chance to finish it because I interrupted you. But about putting new plumbing in a county jail, I think. Will you tell that story?
Yeah. So quickly, I got into politics because we were living off the grid and I read this little newspaper. And it said they were going to raise our taxes to fund this cronyism in the county, the conservation district, which was building stuff for themselves and not for other farmers. They wanted to tax other farmers to help their farm, right? It wasn't really about conserving. Farmers are the best conservationists there are. So let's don't punish them anymore. Okay.
Good call.
So I fought that tax And then I actually fought zoning in our county. They wanted to zone our county. I mean, zoning is to keep the smokestacks out of the cul-de-sacs.
Right.
Okay. My county didn't have any smokestacks and didn't have any cul-de-sacs, right? We the neighborhood in E.T., you know, that movie where the kids ride their bikes through the neighborhood. We didn't have neighborhoods like that. So we didn't need zoning, but somebody thought if we zoned the county that we would get prosperity because they saw all the prosperous counties had zoning.
It's like, I love that.
It's cargo cult.
That, right? No, totally. It's like saying we should import some homeless because then we'll have banks.
Right, right.
JP Morgan will move here because in Midtown they're homeless.
They're right. So that was, I was fighting that and writing letters to the editor. And then finally I quit fighting the guy who was doing all this. He's called the county judge executive in Kentucky, like the mayor of the county. And I decided to run against him. So
and you've never been in politics.
Never in my life. Also, there was this guy named Rand Paul who was inspiring, who was taking on the establishment. It was his first run for Senate, and he decided to get involved in his race, too. So just like with my house, I didn't go in partway. I went in all in, okay, on politics one fall, actually one spring, because I had to win the primary, and Rand did, too. And so actually did a fundraiser for Rand at my house when nobody wanted to do a fundraiser for Rand Paul because he was running against the establishment. My house wasn't finished. We weren't even living in it yet. Sorry, little
but
sidebar.
But you traipsed up from the double wide.
To yes, we went to the double wide and we said for $100, you can come to our pizza party. I did have the pizza oven working. And
which you built the pizza oven before the bedrooms?
Yes.
Priorities.
That's right. Had to test it out, make sure it was inhabitable. So, the funny thing too, we didn't have doors on the bathrooms at the time. We had no doors. So we did run to Lowe's the day before Rand Paul came and put a door on the bathroom.
Good call.
Because I was like, look, this guy could be a senator someday and he might need to go to the bathroom and we need something more than a curtain here. So we call it the Rand Paul door on the bathroom. It's the one room that had a door from the very beginning. Anyways. We did, by the way, also this was in January and Rand is cheap as hell. He had a 2-wheel drive SUV. So I had to plow all my driveway so that he could get up there. And the problem is it's gravel. So I had to plow all my gravel off practically. Ooh. Just to get, so for what it cost to upgrade to the 4-wheel drive for Rand Paul, I like my gravel costs way more than that.
Yes.
Anyways, I went all in on politics. Helped Rand get elected in his primary. I was on the ballot the same day in 2010, the primary, May 22nd, 2010. Rand was on the ballot and I was on the ballot, but I was running for this little county executive seat trying to take a Republican out because he's trying to raise our taxes and bring in more government. And so I won the election and it was like the most terrifying thing when they handed me the key to the courthouse. Like it's a small town. And if the janitor didn't show up to open the courthouse and start the boiler, which looked like the African Queen, like it was like, you had to kick it and do all this stuff to get it started. The sheriff's office wouldn't be heated. The clerk's office wouldn't be heated. And my office wouldn't be heated if I couldn't get the African Queen to start. So anyways, it was like the dog that caught the bus. And I had promised I wouldn't raise taxes. And I was immediately confronted with all these problems that had accumulated over the years in our county government. And the jailer came to me, who's an elected official in Kentucky. His name's Chris. And he got elected the same day I got elected. And he was all in on my, you know, let's reform this county. But he had some bad news for me. By the way, the state government had sold the county government a bill of goods. They said, if you'll keep our state inmates, we'll pay you $32 a day and you'll make all kinds of money. And like, the county was $1 million in debt because this did not work out. And I wasn't going to spend another penny, you know, on this throwing good money after bad. And, but we had 30 state inmates who go out and pick up trash and, you know, mow around the courthouse and they get real sweaty. And the hot water heater had quit working at the jail.
Ooh.
And so the jailer, Chris, comes to me and says, Judge, they call me Judge, even though I'm not an attorney. I was the county judge executive. He said, Judge, I got some bad news. I said, what's that? He said, well, the hot water heater quit working on the state inmate side. And I can't mix state inmates with local inmates. You know, you get murderers along with non-support, you know, for child
totally in DUI cases.
Yeah. It's like this, we can't have them taking showers together. It's just not going to work. And I said, okay, we'll just buy another hot water heater. And he said, well, I tried that. I got a quote. We only had one licensed plumber in the county. And I said, well, what was the quote? He said $12,000. I said, I mean, this is a small county.
For a hot water heater?
For a hot water. Like, all of our property taxes together were like $400,000. I mean, $12,000 for a hot, I'm not paying $12,000 for a hot water heater. You tell that guy to get lost. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I was like, I'll go buy one at, you know, the hardware store or something. So I go look at this hot water heater at the jail. It is not the kind you buy at the store. It's like a boiler almost. And it's fairly involved. It's got like 1.25 inch copper lines. It's not household plumbing. But I had I had 3 books on plumbing, right? I felt fairly confident. I said, well, if I can find one of these, I'll put it in myself. So I got on eBay and I looked for this model hot water. There was one, buy it now for $5,500. And I'm like, I can save the county like $6,500. So I called an emergency meeting of our fiscal court, brought in the magistrates, noticed it to the newspaper, did it all legally, and made a motion to buy it now on eBay. And then I hit the button. I bought this hot water heater. They bring it in a tractor trailer. I didn't pay extra for the lift gate because I had inmates. The inmates take this thing out of the tractor trailer, and we go in and we take the old hot water heater out. And there were three inmates in that closet, right, working on that hot water heater, just demolishing everything. So they dragged that thing out of there, and I had to go in the closet with the inmates to put the new one in. I'm like, I only want one inmate in that closet with me.
Fair.
The hot water heater needs plumbed. I don't need plumbed. Like, so the other two inmates that were smelling pretty rank at this point, I said, you guys – go strip the old hot water heater. I want anything of value on that. Besides, you're in here for stripping copper and other things. Like,
you're good at this. Like,
we can do this, Judge. We know short iron's bringing this, tin's bringing this, copper will bring this, aluminum. They could quote every price at the salvage.
Seriously?
Site. Yeah. So I leave the two inmates stripping the old hot water heater, and it had a computer on it and stuff. And I'm installing the new hot water heater. And I noticed, for instance, even like the plumber had left off this water trap that keeps gases from escaping, like a safety device. So I made sure to do it completely safe by the book, or by the 3 books that I had. And I come out of the closet. By the way, there's like 30 inmates. I had to walk by the rec room that had a piece of glass, and they could all watch me changing this hot water heater. And there's like 30 inmates, like, in disbelief with their hands and faces pressed to the glass. Like, we have never seen a county judge executive get a callus on his hand or do anything. So, I go back out, and the inmate said, we got everything of value. There was this hulk of an old hot water heater sitting there. They had stripped the copper. They had stripped all of the useful iron off of it. And I said, guys, you left the most valuable thing on it. And they said, no, Judge, we've done this all our lives. We stripped these things. There's nothing on here that'll bring anything down at Livingston's. That was the junkyard place, recycling place. And I said, no, you left the most valuable thing. I said, come over here. And they walk over, and I said, you see this lime green inspection sticker? Get it wet and peel it off and glue it on the new hot water heater. Remember, I refused to hire the only licensed plumber in the county. They go, Judge, you could go to jail for this. I said, I'll have a hot shower, won't I?
You actually did that?
I did that. And the only reason I'm telling you this publicly is this was, how long was it? Like 15 years ago or something. And, 14 years ago, I think the statute of limitations, you know, of practicing it without a license as a plumber on a public building, is probably expired. If not, the DOJ will be at my house as soon as this airs. But they have also since closed down the jail. Like a few years later, it was a good move.
Did they take the water heater with them?
It's on my bucket list. It may still be in there.
So what are they using it for now?
It's, I think it's just vacant. Maybe they'll use it for drug rehab or something at some point, which would make more sense.
But did it work? Yet. Did your hot water?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It booted up. The computer came on, and everybody got, 30 inmates just waiting to take a hot shower. And it worked and worked and worked until they shut the jail down.
That's so incredible.
But anyways, that set the tone. Like, you could say, well, you're the executive of the county and you shouldn't be wasting your time on that. But I mean, I had 4 hours of effort in it, and I saved the county $6,500. And I'm like, no, this is worth my time. And it also shows the inmates like, okay, we're buying you $1.50 lunches instead of the $2 lunches now, because we fired the crony who was doing the food system.
Totally.
And they were less likely to complain when they saw that the judge himself was actually willing to change the hot water heater. But it also set the tone for the sheriff and the county clerk and everybody else who sees that. And it's like, man, he is a cheap bastard. Like, I'm not going to go ask him at the next fiscal court meeting for anything.
Why don't you tell the story to AIPAC and maybe they'll leave you alone? It's like, it's not personal. I'm not against you or your country. I just don't want to spend more money.
By the way, I'm probably, there will be some plumbing lobby against me next week see this.
Well, the one thing I know for a fact is that you will bravely stand up to the irate plumbing lobby.
I will. One more story about lobbies. So I introduced this raw milk bill in Congress. And I, you know, food freedom, empower small farmers. It's more nutritious. I thought there was nothing to hate about it. I got 20 co-sponsors. I put it in the hopper. I got my HR number. And that day, the milk lobby comes after me. Like, they said there wouldn't be enough hospital rooms for all the children who were going to die from raw milk if my bill passed. And this is kind of weird. You've got a lobby going after its own product, the milk lobby. So my wife saw all these things come up on her alerts on her phone, and she texted me. She was worried about me, and she says, OMG, I didn't realize the lactose lobby was this intolerant.
Oh, that's brilliant. You said that? That's pretty awesome. Thomas Massey, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Tucker.
Amazing. Thanks for watching. You can go to tuckercarlson.com for our entire library of everything we've done, and we hope you will.